From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On this July 4th edition of Fresh Air, two creators of one of America's greatest products, Rhythm and Blues. We feature an interview with Johnny Otis. His R&B Caravan was the first R&B touring roadshow. Otis discovered such singers as Etta James, Little Esther, Jackie Wilson, Big Mama Thornton, and Hank Ballard. He had the 1958 hit Willie and the Hand Jive. And we'll talk with Laverne Baker about making hits in the 50s and early 60s, including Jim Dandy, Tweedledee Dee, and Bumblebee. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new Lester Young reissue. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Rwandan rebels have taken control of Kigali, the country's capital. They've captured the government army headquarters, too. Rebel forces moving in southwestern Rwanda are warning French troops in the country not to stop them. A spokesman for the Rwandan Rebel Patriotic Front says the French are only protecting the Rwandan government, which they say is responsible for most of the hundreds of thousands of killings. Relief groups warn that there'll be another flood of refugees headed west for the border. There are more reports that the rebels have taken the southern town of Butare. French President François Mitterrand is in South Africa. He is the first Western head of state to officially visit the country since Nelson Mandela was inaugurated as president. Mitterrand has spoken to the South African Parliament today. NPR's Ann Cooper reports.
The visit of the French president is yet another sign of South Africa's rapid re-entry into the world community. The French entourage includes businessmen eager to expand trade with South Africa now that apartheid-era economic sanctions have been scrapped. President Mandela greeted his French guest with full military honors in Cape Town this morning. Mitterrand's itinerary includes tours of black communities outside of Cape Town and Johannesburg. His trip is seen as part of an effort to raise France's profile in Africa. Last month, as plans stalled for an international peacekeeping force to Rwanda, France unilaterally sent its own troops to aid civilians caught in Rwanda's gruesome civil war. I'm Ann Cooper in Johannesburg.
FBI Director Louis Freeh has called for increased cooperation between the United States and Russia to fight the growing threat of Russian organized crime. Freeh is meeting in Moscow with Russian security officials. NPR's Mike Schuster reports.
The scale of organized crime is enormous, FBI Director Freeh told a gathering of hundreds of Russian police today, adding the criminals of various nations often cooperate better than the police. So Freeh appealed for help from Russia to combat Russian organized crime in the United States, and he said the U.S. stands ready to help Russia in its fight against hundreds of rapidly growing crime groups. Freeh has met with a wide variety of senior Russian officials, and both sides have agreed to an exchange of information, investigative methods, witnesses, and evidence, and in some cases, investigators themselves in the effort to control crime. The FBI is also opening an office in the U.S. Embassy here to ensure better communications with its Russian counterparts. Freeh is at the end of an eight-nation tour of Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union. I'm Mike Schuster in Moscow.
Crews are going to try to move parts of a U.S. airplane that crashed near Charlotte, North Carolina over the weekend. A city spokesman says workers are clearing a path so that a large crane can come in to lift the tail section off a house. Then they have to cut away parts of the house to get at the embedded piece of plane. Saturday's crash killed 37 people. This is NPR. It's an all-day 4th of July celebration in the nation's capital. The National Independence Day Parade honors the nation's 218th birthday. There's a concert later today hosted by actor Joel Grey. He'll be joined by musicians the Neville Brothers. The climax of the day's events will be a massive fireworks display on the National Mall. The concert will be broadcast live and starts at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. There's also the much smaller 4th of July smoke-in to protest the prohibition of marijuana. This is the 25th year of this demonstration, which is scheduled for Lafayette Park across from the White House. It's sponsored by the 4th of July Hemp Coalition. Heavy rain from the breakup of Tropical Storm Alberto is flooding southwestern Georgia. James R. Groves of Peach State Public Radio has this report.
The heavy rains moved into southwest Georgia Sunday morning, shortly after Tropical Storm Alberto moved ashore. The rainfall associated with the storm saturated farmland throughout the region and flooded streets in Columbus. One of the hardest hit areas was the city of Cuthbert, which has received more than 8 inches of rain during the last 24 hours. Fire officials in Cuthbert say two families had to be evacuated from their homes. In addition, portions of two major highways outside the city are also underwater. The worst is over for southwest Georgia, but not for other parts of the state. The National Weather Service is predicting 2 to 3 inches of rain in Atlanta today, which could delay or force the cancellation of July 4th celebrations throughout the city. For National Public Radio, I'm James R. Groves in Atlanta.
The Greek Public Order Minister says a Turkish diplomat was assassinated today outside his home in Athens. Three armed men killed him and then escaped into heavy traffic. The Turkish government has lodged a strong protest with the Greek government. The Greek government says this is the same type of pistol used by the guerrilla group known as November 17th. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Johnny Otis has been a rhythm and blues musician, singer, band leader, songwriter, producer, and talent scout. He started out leading a big band. Then he organized a smaller unit that played a hybrid of swing and blues that became known as rhythm and blues. Otis's R&B Caravan became the first rhythm and blues touring road show. Through his nightclub, talent shows, and road show, Otis discovered such singers as Etta James, Little Esther, Jackie Wilson, Big Mama Thornton, and Hank Ballard. Otis had many rhythm and blues hits in the early 50s. In 1958, his record Willie and the Hand Jive made it to the top 10 of the R&B charts. Although Otis is a pioneer of R&B and has played almost exclusively with black performers, he is a white Greek-American. This year, Otis was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and the Rhythm and Blues Hall of Fame. His album, Spirit of the Black Territory Bands, was nominated for a Grammy. And his autobiography, Upside Your Head, was published. When I spoke with him in 1989, we opened with his first hit, the 1945 recording Harlem Nocturne. There's a great story behind recording this record. Would you tell it?
Well, this goes back to the mid-40s, and it was my first record date with my own band, as I recall. And we did three things. I went to the producer after we had completed the third one. I said, well, Mr. Rene, that's it. Three songs in 4 hours, and we got plenty of time left. He said, no, you've got that wrong. It's four songs in 3 hours. Now get out there and get another song together. So we were the house band at the Club Alabama on Central Avenue here in L.A. at the time. And I remember when we would play this particular song, the chorus girls and the showgirls would come out of the balcony, out of their dressing rooms and dance on the balcony. And they would always ask us to play it. And I thought it must have some charm. The ladies like it that well. So I said, let's play that. And it was a stock arrangement that had been recorded once before by Ray Noble. And an Earl Hagen tune. So, but I slowed it down, and I was a drummer then. I then went boom, boom, boom on the tom-toms, and we recorded it. And the songs that we had done previously with Jimmy Rushin, the great Count Basie singer, and some wonderful arrangements, they didn't do it, but Harlem Nocturne became an instant hit.
And when Harlem Nocturne became an instant hit, then you started touring with Louis Jordan and with the Ink Spots. And they were some of the biggest black acts of the time. Can you describe a little bit what the atmosphere was like at the concerts in which you shared the bill?
Well, both of these people were so popular at the time, having had all these big hit records, that there was that same feeling you feel today before the curtain opens, that great anticipation. They're going to see Bill Kenny and the Ink Spots. They're going to see Louis Jordan. And we were lucky enough to be the band. And, of course, that gave us a lot of help.
Did the audiences assume that you were black?
Of course. In those days, many of the places we played, had they suspected I was white, we would have been arrested.
Well, I remember when I interviewed Solomon Burke, he told a story about how when one of his records crossed over to the country charts, he started getting invitations to play certain places in the South with white crowds who would have never asked him to play if they knew he was black, and he showed up to one of these places, and it was quite a scene. Did anything similar ever happen to you?
No. We're talking now, I assume we're back in the 40s. If we are, it was much different than the Solomon Burke days of the 50s or the 60s with Solomon Burke. You see, your life was on the line in those days. When our bus would cross the Mason-Dixon line and the driver would say, well, we just crossed the Mason-Dixon line, a pall would fall over the entire show. We'd all get quiet because we knew we were down there where we had problems. And many times we came close to being hurt. One time we stopped the bus to go to get some gas, and my little singer, little Esther, who was only 13, jumped off and went to the restroom. And I looked up, and there's a guy with a gun in my belly. And he's shaking, and he's all excited because the little black girl went to the white woman's bathroom. And I thought to myself, any death but this. But so she came out, and we went on down the road. But those things happened to us all the time. That was the open version of white racism as against the very subtle, pervasive, and institutionalized version that we have today.
Were in segregated places, were you treated as white or as black when you were traveling with black groups?
In black, as black, there's nothing so unique about a light black person. That's always been the case. And if I'm sitting on the black side having dinner, nobody questions it. He wouldn't be over there if he wasn't black. He ain't crazy, because we'd kill him.
Did you do anything to look more black?
No.
Mm-hmm. Let me play one of the rhythm and blues records from the period that you made, and this was with the singer Little Esther, who we now know as Esther Phillips. And this was Double Crossing Blues. Do you want to say anything about this? You write
the
song?
Well, I can give you a little anecdote about it.
Yeah.
I was leaving my little chicken ranch in Watts back in the 40s, and with me were a group of guys I had found at the Barrel House, where I had a nightclub there called the Barrel House. Mm-hmm. And we were going to do their first record, and they became known as the Robins and later the Coasters. But Little Esther was a neighborhood little girl who used to help me with the other children catch my chickens when people would pick out the chicken they wanted. And then we would have refreshments later. And she ran up. She said, Johnny, let me go. So I said, oh, get in. So she got in. We went to Hollywood to the studio. And when we got there, we did the four sides by the Robins, and we had a few minutes left. So I asked the producer, Ralph Bass, I said, man, we got some time. Let me get these kids together. I got a song I think would make sense. He said, well, hurry up. You've only got a couple minutes. So I taught it to him, and we did it. And it was called Double Crossing Blues. And I said, can I do it one more time? Because she kind of giggled. He said, no, that's it. But anyhow, that became the number one song of 1950, and it brought Little Esther to stardom, and it did an awful lot for us too. And by the way, the bass singer that you will hear on this record is the voice later who became Charlie Brown. How come everybody's always messing with the same guy
from the Coasters?
He was just a worker at my club, and I noticed he could sing and put him into this group, and he wound up singing on this big hit record with Esther Phillips.
Oh,
Bobby Nunn is his name.
And you're playing Vibes.
Yeah, and I'm playing Vibes.
Okay, here we go.
Been looking for you, Daddy. I just found you in time. You hit some other woman and just swore that you were mine. What's the matter, Daddy? Don't my kisses satisfy? If I don't thrill you, baby, goodness knows what I've tried. For it's true. While I can't quit you, baby, 'cause I'm so in love with you. What's the matter, Daddy? If you would only tell me why. If I don't thrill you, baby, goodness knows all I've tried.
You stayed out last night, say you were playing cards. Can't understand it, baby, what makes your big fat head so hard.
You discovered a lot of talent, not just a little Esther Phillips. What was your way of scouting for people?
Actually, my first singer was Ernestine Anderson when she was just a little girl.
Really?
Then, yeah. And then came Esther Phillips. But after Esther Phillips's amazing success and became the big child star of the African-American community nationally, then everywhere we played, people, they would bring me their sons and their daughters backstage. I guess they figured I was an expert who knew how to make stars out of kids. And that's how it started. One day in Detroit at the Paradise Theater, I asked the manager, I said, during this week that we'll be here, how about me doing a talent show to avoid having to have all these people coming around with their kids? He said, great. And we did. It was to have been 1 hour, but it stretched into 2 hours. And we found so many wonderful singers and players that day. I found Little Willie John, Jackie Wilson, and Hank Ballard and the Midnighters on that particular show. And there were probably others, but the record company I was scouting for, King, only wanted to deal with three at the moment. And I thought, years later, when Berry Gordy formed his great Motown story, I said, no wonder, look at the reservoir of talent here in Detroit.
It must have been funny, though, when the parents were bringing you their children. You must have been exposed to a lot of really untalented kids also.
Well, I learned quick. They would come and say, and they almost all had exactly, and I don't care if I was in Mississippi or Massachusetts, they would say, now, Mr. Otis, we know that you know, and if Junior has any real talent, you'll tell us the truth. And if he doesn't, of course, you'll. But they didn't mean that. I didn't know it. What they meant was, this is the world's answer to the great child star. This is it. And if I would dare to suggest they weren't, then I had an enemy on my hands. So I learned how to sidestep that and tell little fibs.
Let's take a short break, then we'll talk some more. My guest is rhythm and blues musician and band leader Johnny Otis. His hits have included Willie and the Hand Jive, and he launched the careers of singers such as Jackie Wilson, Etta James, and Big Mama Thornton. This is Fresh Air. Johnny Otis is my guest. We've been talking about rhythm and blues. When there was the transition between rhythm and blues and rock and roll, did you have to, did you find yourself changing the music, or were maybe the audiences changing that you were playing your music to?
Yeah, that's true. When I was dealing with the classic rhythm and blues that we developed back in the 40s, we did a lot of bluesy material because the black audience demanded it. As the transition occurred and as it developed, we then had to play more animated jump blues, boogie styles, and act, put on an act for white folks because they wanted it to be, well, they wanted to see us, you know, work and sweat, and that's what they liked. The early black audiences wanted a more musical, bluesy, jazz thing. The white audiences wanted that jump tune, boogie-woogie kind of thing. But what a strange thing has happened as the years went by. The roles reversed. Today, our audience for blues-oriented music is white, and the white and the black youngsters are not interested, and that's something that pains us terribly for many reasons, not just personally, but when we start to think from a cultural standpoint, how much we seem to have lost over the past 20 years or so in the African-American community where blues and jazz artistry is concerned.
Well, I want to play a song that you had that was a hit on the rock and roll charts in 1958, and this is Willie and the Hand Jive. Let's play it, and then we'll talk about it.
I know a cat named Way Out Willie. He got a cool little chick named Rockin' Billy. He can walk and stroll in Susie Q and do that crazy hand jive too. Papa told Willie, you'll ruin my home. You and that hand jive has got to go. Willie said, Papa, don't put me down. They're doing that hand jive all over town.
That's Hand Jive, which was a big hit for my guest, Johnny Otis, back in 1958. Tell me about writing the song.
My manager, the late Hal Zeiger and partner back at that time, we had a hit in 57 called Ma's Making Eyes at Me with the great Marie Adams singing, and it became a hit, not here in the States, but in Europe. In England, it was number one. So he went over to set up the tour, and when he got back, he said, listen, I saw something interesting. I saw the young people around the London area in the venues where they couldn't dance, at the concerts and the theaters. As they sat there, they would do a thing that you guys in the big black bands used to do with their hands, you know, while the band was playing. And they call it Hand Jive. Why don't you write a song called Hand Jive, and maybe we'll do some good over in Europe. Well, I did, and luckily it became a hit everywhere.
So the Hand Jive was basically just kind of clapping and moving your hands.
Yeah, while you're sitting.
While you're sitting in a dance.
But it became a whole dance later.
Well, you know, the Hand Jive is reissued on this new Capitol album, the Capitol Years. And inside, there's a little insert. Let me see if I can find it.
Yeah, and it's the thing that tells you how to do the Hand Jive dance. And it's all patterned out where you put your feet.
Exactly, yeah. It tells you, like, when to do the right-hand salute and the left-hand salute.
Yeah. I dare you to try to figure it out.
Oh, believe me, I was looking at it before. I thought it would be impossible.
Yeah.
I want to play something that you're featured on from this new reissue called The Capitol Years. And this is Can't You Hear Me Calling?
Okay.
And you're singing on this?
Yeah.
And what are you playing?
After a fashion.
Oh, you sound really good on it.
Oh, well, okay. You and my mother think so.
Okay, well, let's give it a listen.
Can't you hear me calling, baby, 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 please don't go.
Baby, please don't go.
Baby, don't you know I love, love, I love,
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 I love you so.
I love you so.
And now you got me all alone, alone and blue, and I'm sitting here crying over you. Can't you hear me calling, baby? Calling, I can't go on.
I can't go on.
Now you know you got me crying,
crying,
crying, crying. I'm all alone.
I'm all alone.
Come on, baby, won't you tell me that you're coming home? Don't leave me crying here all alone. Can't you hear me calling, baby? Baby, please don't go.
Don't go.
In the morning.
Johnny Otis from the Capitol Years. You know, Ben Vaughan wrote the liner notes for this record, and in it he mentions that I guess it was a publicity shot, that your goatee was airbrushed out so that you would look less ethnic. What was the story behind that?
Oh, Hal Zeiger, the late Hal Zeiger, God rest his soul, he was my partner at the time, and he did these things without even asking me. And while he wanted me to look less black, he wanted me to look less like a Greek. He wanted me to look like a nice Anglo-Saxon wasp, which is hard to do, but he tried.
So he airbrushed out the goatee?
Yeah. I don't think that sold any records.
Now, your family is Greek? Was Greek?
Yeah.
Your parents?
Yeah. And yeah, we're and are. Yes.
And your last name was Veliotis?
Veliotis.
And when did you change it to Otis?
The kids at school kind of made that decision for me. They decided not to deal with try to remember how to pronounce that. They would say Johnny Otis, and that's the way it stuck.
So I know that your father had a grocery store. Was that in the same neighborhood that you lived in?
Oh, yes. The grocery store was downstairs, and we lived upstairs.
And this was in a black neighborhood?
Yes, in the heart of the black neighborhood.
So that, I guess, helps explain why you grew up with such black identification.
And that's also the luckiest thing that ever happened to me.
Uh-huh. So,
He might, in fact, have put it in a WASP neighborhood. Then what would have happened to me?
Did you not think of yourself as being white when you were growing up?
I didn't think about that at all. I had no concept about that. Luckily, my father was absolutely wonderful in that respect. And my playmates were, I didn't know it then, but they were black, African-American. I thought we were all the same thing. And I don't think it's so unique in America for white kids to grow up with black youngsters and come up together as brothers and sisters. What might be unique is not to veer away. I could not veer away because that's where I wanted to be. Those were my friends. That's where what I loved. It wasn't the music that brought me to the black community. It was the way of life. I felt I was black.
What was it about the way of life?
Everything about it. You know, different cultures have different characteristics. And the characteristics of the African-American community became my own. And I just wasn't willing to give that up to go become part of the mainstream community where people felt superior to black people and they oppressed black people and they practiced democracy and preached racism. I didn't want to be part of that. I want to stay in that sweet, beautiful black place in the black community.
Johnny Otis, recorded in 1989. Let's go out with a track from his recent CD, The Spirit of the Territory Bands. We'll hear Flying Home with Johnny Otis featured on Vibes. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, a powerful voice from the early days of rock and roll. We hear from Laverne Baker. She made the hits Bumblebee, Jim Dandy, and Tweedledee Dee. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new Lester Young reissue. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The French government is bracing for a possible confrontation with one of the warring factions in Rwanda following its decision to create a safe area for civilians. The Tutsi-led Rwanda Patriotic Front, which opposes the French humanitarian mission, is advancing toward the safe area. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
11 days ago, when France began its humanitarian mission in Rwanda, it said it would remain neutral. But now it looks like France might become embroiled in a civil war. French government said today French troops would create a safe area in western Rwanda as hordes of refugees flee westward and the rebel troops advance. The Rwanda Patriotic Front has captured the capital of Rwanda, its second largest town, and is continuing its drive westward towards a safe area. The RPF says it will continue its advance. However, the French government said it was determined to protect the safe area. French military official in Rwanda said if the RPF comes and threatens civilians, we'll shoot at them without hesitation. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
The remnants of Tropical Storm Alberto are still troubling the southeast. Authorities in southern Georgia are still reporting flooding. The city of Cuthbert has been affected and several residents have been evacuated. There is also street flooding in Columbus, Georgia. The National Weather Service says heavy rain will taper off sometime today in southwest Georgia and move north. Flash flood watches have been posted in north and central Georgia. Tourism is down at Arizona's Grand Canyon National Park, and local business owners are blaming the Park Service for scaring people away. Doug Ramsey, a member station KJZZ, reports.
The Park Service had warned of massive crowds this summer after some 5 million people visited Grand Canyon last year. But visitation in May was down 7% from a year ago, resulting in less business for local shops, hotels, and restaurants. The local Chamber of Commerce president says in reacting to the overcrowding of past years, the Park Service may have actually done its job a little too well. In March, the park superintendent urged visitors to leave their cars in cities over 60 miles away. But a Grand Canyon Park spokeswoman says a number of factors may explain the tourism downturn. She says European visitors are fewer because of publicity from tourist killings in Florida and California, the L.A. earthquake, and the deadly hantavirus outbreak in the Four Corners area. For National Public Radio, I'm Doug Ramsey in Phoenix.
A wildfire in Southern California has scorched 13,000 acres of land and is threatening 500 homes. The blaze near Palm Desert has already burned 10 homes. A U.S. Forest Service spokesman says winds are pushing the fire toward the north from the Palm Canyon area, about 6 miles south of Palm Springs. About 1,000 firefighters are working in steep terrain. The stock market is closed today. This is NPR. A former Japanese army officer is reported to have admitted that Japan destroyed evidence about its germ warfare program at the end of the Second World War. The Kyoto News Agency quotes the officer as saying that he was personally involved in ordering the destruction of the records. Katie Kay reports from Tokyo.
The former army officer told Kyoto News that on August the 15th, 1945, just hours before Japan surrendered, he ordered the destruction of all evidence relating to Japan's germ warfare program. He said he realized then that if it came to light that Japan had been developing bacteriological weapons, it would have been, as he put it, awkward in view of international law. One recipient of the officer's orders was the infamous Unit 731, a military group which conducted gruesome experiments on live prisoners at a secret germ warfare laboratory. thousands of prisoners, mainly Chinese, Koreans, Russians, and Mongolians, are thought to have died during those experiments. The officer's statement comes at a time when Japanese are just starting to learn about their country's war record. Until recently, discussion of the war was taboo here.
Katty Kay reporting for the BBC. The FBI has opened its new bureau office in Moscow, Russia. FBI Chief Louis Free says the two-agent office will work to prevent the Russian crime wave from spreading to the United States. One of the Bureau's main tasks will be to trade information with the Russian government on criminal activity. This includes possible attempts to smuggle nuclear material out of the country. The office will be supervised by the American ambassador. The United States has opened an embassy today in Sarajevo. Officials threw a garden party that doubled as an Independence Day celebration. The United States joins Croatia, Turkey, and Iran with active embassies in the city. Austria and Great Britain have ambassadors who shuttle in and out of Sarajevo. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this holiday edition of Fresh Air, we have a 1991 interview with one of the rhythm and blues stars of the 50s and early 60s, Laverne Baker. She was one of Atlantic Records' first big success stories, with hits like Jim Dandy, Tweedledee Dee, and Bumblebee. And it was Atlantic Records that revived her career in 1988 by having her perform in their 40th anniversary celebration at Madison Square Garden. She spent most of the intervening years as the entertainment director at the Subic military base in the Philippines. She returned to the States shortly before the base closed. In the past few years, she performed in the Broadway R&B revue Black and Blue, recorded a song for the Dick Tracy soundtrack, and released a 1992 album called Woke Up This Morning. I asked her if she's still singing her old novelty hit, Bumblebee.
I'm singing it now, and I feel so very, very funny singing that.
Why do you feel funny about it?
Well, because I was, you know, very, very young, and at the time it fitted me, you know. It was good, and I had a big hit with it with the kids. But now I'm much older. I feel funny singing it, you know, but I'll do it. You know, I do it, and I'm surprised that my voice can reach the squeaky part now. I still can do it, so I do it. You know, if someone asks for it, I'll do it.
So do you do it differently?
No, I do it the same. The same. I do all of my recordings identical, the same. Matter of fact, I have hired two backup singers to do the background so that the people will know, you know, what they heard before. It still sounds the same.
Okay, let's listen to Laverne Baker, and this is Bumblebee.
Shut, shut, shut. I'm gonna have to put you shut, down.
Shut, shut.
You've been treating me like a
shut,
child.
Shut.
You know you've hurt me once before.
Shut, shut. Shut.
You'll never hurt me anymore.
Shut, shut. Shut. Shooey, you hurt me like a bee.
A bumblebee, an evil bumblebee.
Shut, shut.
I gave you love as sweet as honey.
Shut,
my life, my soul, and all my money.
Shut, shut.
You didn't seem to realize.
Shut.
You had a home in paradise.
Shooey, you hurt me like a bee.
A bumblebee, an evil bumblebee. Don't you know I cry night after night? Just one kiss before you go. Don't ever come back no more. Now, baby, there's no need of crying.
So my guest Laverne Baker is recorded in 1960. Now, Laverne Baker, you were born in Chicago, and you started performing in your teens.
Yes.
And when you started performing in clubs around Chicago, you were known as Little Miss Sharecropper. Who gave you that name?
Regretfully, yes. Some guy. Well, it was a long story. It's like at the big club, Delisa, which was the place during those early 40s, 50s in Chicago. And they had a singer there named Little Miss Cornshuck. And she was a great singer. And she used to come out with a little, like, Bo Peep outfit on, with a little basket and mm-hmm. ribbons in her hair. And she was, quite famous. Her name was the Talk of Chicago. And she got on the wrong path, you know, and wasn't able to perform. So then they were looking for someone to take her place. So I met this guy at another one of our big clubs. I went to see the show, and I did a guest number. And he said, you know, they're looking for a good singer at Club Delisa. So I was a little nervous to go to the breakfast dance because I didn't have no business out that, you know, all night long at that, during those years, you know, because the breakfast dance started at 6 o'clock in the morning. But I slipped and went anyway. And I got the job. And the next thing I knew, they had put these little costumes and ribbons and baskets in my hand, and they called me Little Miss Sharecropper because they couldn't use corn shuck, you know, and Sharecropper was related to that. But about 2 years after I left, I hurried up and got rid of it. So,
did you protest when they wanted to outfit you that way? And
no,
call you
I
that?
Didn't. You know, you got to get your foot in the door before you can say anything in regards to what you do. You know, I wasn't strong. I just wanted to get started, and I didn't care how, you know, as long as it was legit, you know. So they wanted me to sing. And hey, I enjoyed it for a while, you know. But then as I started to mature, you know, and I saw other singers, you know, looking so beautiful on stage, I didn't like it anymore.
Now, I want to read you a review from Variety. And this is from 1954, the year that you signed with Atlantic.
Wow.
And this is a review of you at the Apollo.
Oh, I see.
And the reviewer wrote, "She's a strong-voiced looker who embellishes her singing with movement and suggestiveness worthy of any grind artist. And while this goes well at the Apollo, she'll have to hold back in other situations." weird review, but I was wondering, you know, what were you doing in your act then, and did you have to change what you were doing
in
terms of emotions?
Yes. Yes. As you mature, you know, like for one-nighters and the Apollo, that was great, you know?
What were you doing?
I have a thing I do. I turn around and my behind moves, you know, and stuff like that. You know, I still can do it. You know, it's all muscle control type thing, you know. But the audience go crazy when you do this, you know, and the young audiences back then in rock and roll. And at that time, I was not playing sophisticated and big nightclubs. I was doing strictly one-nighters and theaters. So I had to stick to it. But, you know, as I got a little older, I wanted to change, and I did change. And I made it. I went to Basin Street East with Louis Armstrong more than one time, you know. And I played Vegas. And these are rooms and things that I could not get when I was in rock and roll. So I had to change my act, you see.
Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us, my guest is Laverne Baker. And she had a lot of hits in the 1950s, early 60s, songs like Tweedledee Dee, Bumblebee, Jim Dandy, I Cried a Tear. We'll talk more after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Laverne Baker is my guest. Now, you were one of the first black singers to cross over to a white teenage audience.
Yes.
In the 1950s. Was there a conscious attempt at Atlantic Records to give you certain kind of material or to change your stage act in any way to help you cross over?
No, the music, Atlantic always picked my music, Ahmed and Jerry at the time. They always picked, you know, the songs that they wanted me to sing or they thought that would be best for me. And I never argued at that particular time. I'll fight now, but I didn't argue then. And because they knew what they wanted, you know. But coincidentally, the things that they gave me, I enjoyed doing at that time. So I gave my best at it, you know. And sometimes they would come in the studio and play different things and holler in the background, you know, to make it better, you know, sound like more people.
Did holler in the background on the record?
Yeah. Uh-huh, yeah.
Which record did they do that on?
Quite a few. They'd sing with at that time we had a group called, a backup group called the Q's. And a lot of things, he'd come in and he'd sing with them to show them what he wanted, you see. And this is the way we worked back then, you know. We had a small room and it was like they were on one side and we were on the other, and, you know, and we made millions of hits up there in that little hole that we were in.
Now, I want to play Tweedledee Dee, but, you know, the voices that come in at the beginning,
uh-huh.
They're kind of square-sounding voices, don't you think?
Yes, yeah. These are the Q's, and one of the Q's is the one that wrote Tweedledee Dee, Mr. Winfield Scott. He's the one that wrote it, And that is the longest recording session I've ever had in my life.
What made it so long?
We did 52 takes.
Whoa, you're kidding.
No, I kid you not.
How come? What went
wrong?
Well,
he wasn't satisfied. It was something missing. And during the break, we know they always give us a little break for tea or whatever to rest our voices, you know. And I did, I was kidding with it, and I said, hump, bump, 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 like that. And Ahmed said, that's it, that's it. That we, that's how that got in there. You know, it was just something missing that he wasn't. And he's like that now, you know. He's like that now. Everybody say he's still the same. If he's in a date and he's not comfortable, you know, he knows what he like, you know. And if he don't hear it, he'll keep pushing, you know. So that's that with the Tweedly D session. It was very, very long.
Well, why don't we listen to Tweedly D? And this is my guest, Laverne Baker.
I'm as happy as can be. Chimney Cricket, Chimney Jack, you make my heart go clickety clack.
This Laverne Baker is recorded in 1955, a song that went up to number 14 on the charts. Big hit for you. Now, how did you feel when you were given the song? Did you like the song?
Yes and no.
What was the yes and what was the no?
Well, because, you know, I told you we did so many takes. And it just didn't make any sense to me, okay? You know, and
with the lyric or the
yeah,
text?
The lyric. The music was okay. We had to find the music to really fit it, you know. So I came up with a suggestion of Brazil. If you notice, it's
at the beginning, yeah.
Yeah, dun 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 dun. So you know, and that's why I was so upset when Georgia Gibbs covered my record, because we worked very hard to stay away from the main track of Brazil, just a little taste of it, you know. And then she recorded my song word for word. I was very upset with this because she used my arrangement. Use your own arrangement, you know. That was the only kick, because once the song is PD. Public domain, anybody can sing it, you know. I was really upset with the arrangement because we worked very hard on that.
Georgia Gibbs' cover of your record went up to number 2 on the charts.
I know. It was so many people had they thought they had the original and they didn't. They had hers.
Now, she was a white singer.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Recording your hit.
Yeah.
Were there stations that would play the white singer's version of it that wouldn't play yours?
Oh, yeah. And there were some of them that played hers, and after they found out she wasn't the original, they wouldn't play it anymore. You know, this happened in the whole state of Illinois and Michigan.
In the 1950s, you recorded an entire album of Bessie Smith songs.
Oh, I loved it. Now, that's a recording date I enjoyed. I really did enjoy it. I loved the songs. And after I listened to Bessie Smith, and even now that I'm older, when I do her numbers, I sound more like her, you know. I was told that by the bass player and some of the guys who actually worked with Bessie Smith that was still living, Atlantic got some of the original guys that played with her, you know. And they told me, said, man, you really sound like Bessie, you know. I just had one of those big growling voices, I guess, you know. And it's worse now that I'm older.
Well, it's a great album, and it was reissued recently on compact disc.
Yeah.
So let's play something off of it. This is the opening track, and this is Pigfoot.
Oh.
Tut, tut, tut.
Sounds really terrific. Was Bessie Smith a big influence on you?
No. Let's say singers from that era did, you know. And then my mom and my grandmom, they were all gospel singers in church. So naturally, I grew up in church, you know. That's where most of us come from, you know.
What was it like for you in the 60s when you stopped having hit records and when the kind of records making the pop charts were changing?
Well, I tell you what, I was a smart cookie. I left before it stopped. I realized it was getting slow, and I guess the good Lord was with me. My Asian tour came in right in the middle of that. And I said, well, let me get this, because in Asia, and you're playing the military bases, and they know you, you know, and at that time, you know, it was great, and I had a good show put together. So I really forgot all about it, you know.
Laverne Baker, recorded in 1991. Her latest recordings are The Blue Side of Rock and Roll and Woke Up This Morning. This is Fresh Air.
This is Robert Siegel of All Things Considered. Coming up next, we'll have more news of PLO Chairman Yasser Arafat's visit to Gaza and this week later to Jericho. NPR's Michael Scholar will also report from Rwanda on the mission of the French army there. The French have announced they're establishing defensive positions to try to stop the advance of the Rwandan Patriotic Front, the rebel force that overran the capital city, Kigali, today. Also on today's program, a look at a family in Cumberland, Maryland that makes hot dogs. Their life is all about hot dogs. And on this July 4th, we will hear about them. In addition to which, we'll hear something about American history from the Reduced Shakespeare Company. That's what's coming up next on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says he's a firm believer in the concept of the big lie, that if you repeat something silly often enough, people will start to believe it. Today, Kevin blows the whistle on two big lies, one about the 50th anniversary of a certain record company, the other about the post-war playing of tenor saxophonist Lester Young. Here's Young with Nat Cole on piano and Buddy Rich on drums.
This year, Verve Records is celebrating its 50th anniversary at Carnegie Hall and on TV and with a bunch of CDs, but the label wasn't started till 1956. The excuse was, it's been 50 years since producer Norman Granz recorded the first sessions he eventually issued on that label. Never mind that Granz sold Verve after only 6 years and didn't come to the Carnegie concert and wouldn't have known most of the performers if he had. Anyway, as part of the hoopla, Verve has reissued two fine old sessions produced by Granz on a CD called Lester Young Trio. This is Lester Young, Nat Cole, and Buddy Rich. A trio of Lester Young, Nat Cole, and Buddy Rich sounds like a record producer's idea. Norman Granz wasn't the only producer to throw far-flung players together. Here you have a tenor saxophone star so big everyone knew him by his nickname, Prez, short for the president, and a great piano player who also had a successful singing career and a loud drum solo expert. Producers also love a gimmick. This band had no bass player 50 years before that became a trend. Anyway, this odd session worked. Buddy Rich knew the simple joys of keeping time with brushes, and Lester Young sounded very good after World War II, although the big lie about Prez is he emerged from the army a broken man. They'd kicked him out a few months earlier on a marijuana beef. The broken man myth is a good tragic story, but since Young hated the army, would he be sad they kicked him out? This is I Want to Be Happy. The Lester Young CD also includes another short session from the same period, with Nat Cole again on piano, trumpeter Sweets Edison, and 20-year-old Dexter Gordon on tenor sax. It's obvious Dexter was heavily influenced by Lester Young, but he already had his own wild energy, which would later inspire John Coltrane. Norman Granz recorded that session, perhaps as early as 1943. Hey, wouldn't that make this year the 51st anniversary of Verve Records?
Kevin Whitehead writes for Pulse, CD Review, Coda, and The Village Voice. He reviewed the Verve reissue, Lester Young Trio. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Joan Tuohy, Naomi Person, and Phyllis Myers, with Nancy Greenleaf and Sue Spolin. Research assistance from Louisa Shafia. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, building a gourmet ice cream empire with a social conscience, we talk with the former CEO of Ben & Jerry's, Chico Lager. He's written a new book about the company called The Real Scoop. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.